This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And here's a question for you. Will the average U.S. temperature in January of 2025 be greater than 34 degrees Fahrenheit? Well, at Interactive Brokers, the yes forecast contract recently traded at 14% and no at 84%. Forecast contracts let you trade on future events, whether it's climate change, economic shifts, or even political events. You pick yes or no, and if you're right, you get paid. It's as simple as that. Now, here's the kicker. When you start trading forecast contracts, you'll get $3 to kick things off. So if you got a feeling about where the world's heading, now's your chance to make it count. Trade on real-world events and earn a dollar for every contract if your prediction hits. Ready to put your predictions to the test? Well, check it out at ibkr.com/forecast and start earning from your predictions today. Forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors. And of course, restrictions apply.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets get a gut punch as the wild AI ride continues. Big tech reporting and some interesting moves there. Inflation, well, PCE was in line. That's good. And our guest today is Carson Block from Muddy Waters. All this and much more on episode number 906 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, it's Andrew Horowitz, and welcome to another great edition, an action-packed edition and episode of The Disciplined Investor for the final day of the month. Well, it's more than the final day. We're starting February already, so the month is closed when it comes to the markets. And it was a pretty interesting and entertaining month overall. We had a change of presidency, right? A change of administration. We had some things that happened in AI world that was pretty amazing. And we saw that the economics in the U.S. pretty much on solid footing. So overall, it ended up being a good quarter or a good month. It's only a month at this point. It seems like a quarter. So a good month for markets. And that's across the board with the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is something that people still look at, being the best performer. In fact, you have to look at that and wonder why that was. And it was really the idea that much of the markets that moved were related to things like bank stocks and maybe even to a degree utilities for a little bit, staples. And that is the other side of the equation from what we saw over the last number of years. That was pretty much dedicated and headlined with the growth story and tech. Well, that's changed a little bit right now, and that's why we're seeing a significant differential when it comes to what is performing and what is not. Is it a simple rotation trade? Is it a reversionary to the mean trade? We don't know yet. 1 month does not make a market, but generally speaking, it's something to be aware of. And before we get to some of the things we're going to talk about with our guest today, because we have a lot to talk about with Carson Block, last week we let off with the idea of what is it about this idea that when a president comes in or a new administration or maybe a new Congress that everybody gets very excited and they try to they do their best to look at how to handicap what in fact is going to be the next 4 years. Now in this particular president, we know a little bit more. And the reason is that we saw what President Trump did during his presidency, and it doesn't seem like there's a lot of change right now, right? A lot of rhetoric, a lot of misdirection, a lot of questionable commentary, tariffs, the desire to push markets up as best as possible through things like tax reductions, America First. We know all of that that's happening, right? So we get the ebb and the flow of the excitement and the disappointment with some of the commentary and promises that don't come true, some of the things that do, the comments that maybe are, well, we'll see, but we don't know, and maybe tariffs will go on, but they, all the things that we know about. What I wanted to do and where we left off last week, what I told you I'd talk about is the thing that maybe most people don't understand or maybe don't remember, and that is how the comparison worked with regard to Biden's administration compared to Trump's administration. And I got some stats, some things that I want to talk about. So let's get right into those, right? Now, since Joe Biden took office in January 2021, till the time he left, there was a lot of fluctuations. In 2021, the S&P 500 saw an impressive rise from any standard, closing up the year more than 28%. The NASDAQ 100 composite climbed 27% during that same period. Now, of course, that was on the heels of all the stimulus that was still going on due to COVID. Now, in 2022, that year was pretty much, I would say, more challenging, right? Nothing worked very well at all. Nothing worked at all, as a matter of fact, in 2022. The U.S. stock market is the worst performing since the global financial crisis in 2008. S&P fell 18%. NASDAQ dropped 33%. Now, in 2023, the markets rebounded remarkably. S&P gained 26%. NASDAQ 100, well, that increased 54%. That erased all of the previous year's losses. Now, in 2024, we know bull market continued. The S&P was up 25%. NASDAQ 100 increased by 25%. Okay, overall, during Biden's term, the S&P 500 achieved a total return of 66%, translating to an annualized return near about 13.75%. Now, that performance has surpassed the historical average of the S&P, but it trails the return seen both during Donald Trump's administration and Barack Obama's presidencies. Now, here's the other side. During Trump's term, with all the things that looked bad, the S&P 500, it soared by 83%, even with the 2020 market meltdown due to COVID-19. That translates to an annual return of 16.18% compared to 13.75% under Biden. Now, we're using the election dates rather than the inauguration dates because I think that's fine. But if we did use the inauguration date, actually Biden would have the edge on total market performance. So we know that you can bend statistics any way you want, but I wanted to give you from the actual date of election where people were starting to think about, as markets are a forward discounting mechanism, they say, right? Markets look to the future. They look to see what's happening and they can start, and investors do, and that's when they start to invest. Now, as we transition now from what was Bidenomics to Trumponomics, the landscape from an economic standpoint is clearly poised for significant changes. Now, Bidenomics, if you recall, it was characterized by public investment and what else? Empowering the middle class worker, promoting business competition, which it depends on where you are on that, if whether you like it or not. A lot of things that we saw that were included in this plan and policies that were created, like the American Rescue Plan Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, the Science Act. And these initiatives really were all about green energy, domestic manufacturing, and healthcare affordability. And through that, the stock market saw mixed reactions, with some sectors really benefiting from increased government spending and others really facing challenges due to the higher taxes and regulations and inflation that happened during that period of time as well. Now, Trumponomics, on the other hand, probably going to focus on tax cuts, tariffs, and deregulation, which is what we've been talking about. Trump's economic policies are expected, we think, to include protectionist measures such as tariffs on imports from Europe and China and Canada, and significant tax cuts, maybe, if they can get legislative approval for both individuals and corporations. Deregulation efforts, of course, that's something too that Trump has talked about a lot, targeting environmental, healthcare, and maybe even financial services in the sectors within in finance. Now, during this transition, you know, probably going to cause some short-term market fluctuations And investors need to be aware of that because you got to adapt to these new policies. That's what you can fight up all you want and be pissed off or happy about it, but it doesn't matter. You need to adapt. You need to change. You need to make sure that your portfolio is set right. Now, we've been working on our portfolios for months already, looking at, you know, stronger economic conditions, maybe even stagnating inflation or not changing in inflation, no deflation, higher costs on certain items through tariffs and the deregulatory focus. You need to look out for many of the opportunities that could arise. That is our job as investors. Now, while some sectors probably going to see some benefits from the deregulation, the tax cuts, we may see some other sectors that are going to have some trouble. The trade tensions, the tariffs, and the overall impact that we're going to have on a global economy, and of course the stock markets underlying them, are really going to, it's going to hinge on the implementation, if it's going to actually happen. We don't know what is actually going to happen. There's a lot of maybes, could be's. We're looking at it. We'll see. And that. A lot of jawboning, a lot of rhetoric. Now, remember something, though. The one thing that I've been worried about, when it comes to all these different things that could be beneficial for the economy, tariffs is something that I've been really concerned about. And those can be enacted swiftly. Because those could be just done by executive order, but lowering taxes is going to require congressional approval. And that can lead to some interesting economic impacts, right? If the tariffs are enacted well before any tax legislation is passed. So it's really important for us as investors. We have to be nimble. We have to be ready for any outcome as the Trump team is setting their agenda. We know that presidents may have broad and impactful visions, but really, when we talk about markets, the real muscle behind them and behind the market movements is somewhere else entirely. Government policies, they're shaped by a president and their administration, no question about that, and they certainly have the power to shape the business climate. And it's the businesses themselves, really, in the end, that ultimately sustain market growth through innovation, adaptability, and strategic planning. Key there for all the things we're talking about has been the adaptability. How much you can shift without getting emotionally twisted by what was, what could be, and all that. Forget about that. You like them, you don't like them. It doesn't matter. Because the policies can provide a favorable environment, but companies are still going to be facing the task of navigating the challenges and seizing opportunities. We know that. And the key drivers behind all of this is steady income growth and earnings. And that's based on strong leadership and efficient operational strategies, the effective resource management. And in the end, you're a company. You have to focus on the consumer's needs. What do they need in these environments? So there's a lot of really tricky things that have to fall in place. And that's why we're looking to companies and the best leaders to get us through all this. And the leaders I'm talking about are the company's leaderships. And then we look at global events and things like technology advancements and what happened last week with this DeepSeek and how that's concerning. And of course, Amazon picked up and allowed it on their AWS services. It says, hey, have at it, go play with it. And how that wrecked some of the loved stocks like the NVIDIAs and some of the far-reaching companies in the area of nuclear energy that were going to power some of these amazing life-changing technology advancements. Now, in essence, we know and we have to recognize that political leadership clearly sets the stage, but it's really the companies. That's what I really want to get through to you here. It's the companies and their ability to perform well, regardless of the setting, that's really the determination of what the outcome will be from a market standpoint. Because the best run companies can find ways to excel, even in less than ideal conditions. Didn't we see that just a few years ago during COVID? Thereby, what happens? They maintain or even help drive market performance. And in the end of all of this, the stock market is a market of stocks. One of the greatest ways to create and maintain wealth that was ever created. So I think regardless of what your thought process is of, he was approved to that post and I hate this guy, I love that guy, it doesn't matter. Because we're excited about the fact, and you should be too, that as the promise that we look at being adaptable for ourselves will create the opportunities, and a lot of them, in the next number of years, whether it's 4 years, 8 years, 12 years. Some of the most obvious and ones that you'll see are going to be like, oh, that makes total sense. And some of the others are going to be taking some time to reveal themselves. But the bottom line of all this is that you have to be adaptable, open, and you have to see that there are changes that are going to be occurring, and don't be stuck in quicksand thinking that will disable you to a point that you are going to have a financial problem with your portfolio. Give yourself the permission to realize that we're investing and take the politics somewhere else. Now let's get to our guest, because this is a smart guy that we have coming on. But before we do so, I want to talk about Interactive Brokers, because at Interactive Brokers, you don't have to wait for the markets to open. With around-the-clock trading, you could trade over 10,000 U.S. stocks and ETFs, U.S. equity index futures and options, U.S. treasury bonds, and even more. IBKR's overnight trading helps you stay ahead by, well, it allows you to react instantaneously to market-moving news and economic events whenever they happen. Capture more market opportunities and trade on your timetable whenever it's convenient for you. Enjoy bond trading with no markups, no built-in spreads, and low transparent commissions. Open an Interactive Brokers account today and discover more trading opportunities at ibkr.com/aroundtheclock. Okay, so today we have Carson Block on, and he's the chief investment officer at Muddy Waters LLC, which is an activist investment firm. And Muddy Waters conducts extensive due diligence based on investment research and companies around the globe. Carson is also the founder of Zeros TV, which is www.zeros.tv, an online channel dedicated to short selling, and has related content with that in the video format. Bloomberg's magazine named him one of the 50 most influential in global finance, and he's got so many awards. He's been on just all sorts of TV shows and quoted everywhere. He's been featured in the book, The Most Dangerous Trade, How Short Sellers Uncover Fraud, Keep Markets Honest, and Make and Lose Billions, by former Bloomberg writer Richard Teitelbaum. He was also featured in the 2018 documentary, The China Hustle. He gained fame back in 2011, by a publication on Sinoforest. We're going to talk about that. Massive fraud going on there. He also had all sorts of other activist campaigns, et cetera. He's a frequent commentator on Bloomberg. He's not only a short seller, he does other things too, but smart guy. I want to welcome him back because it's been a while since he's been on. So with that, let's get right in with Carson Block. Carson, it's been a while. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I am good. You know, the question I've been asking a lot of people, even though you were on for a couple times over the years, that I don't think I ever asked before. And I wanted to get down to some of the people that are the greats in the industry and ask a question. It's basically, when did you decide? What was it and when that you said, that's the career I want? And for you, following up, and not only that, when do I want to go against the grain?
Okay, well, against the grain, that was a pattern that I exhibited all throughout childhood and high school. I definitely was somebody who preferred to be, at least in my mind, right versus popular. So record number of detentions at my elementary school. Nice. When I was in sixth grade. Which, a lot of that wasn't actually from being right. But but yeah, the whole against the grain thing was that's pretty much in my DNA. But the short selling, I started my career on the long side. I grew up in the industry. My father was a selling analyst, and he and I worked together for a few years. It's kind of my third job out of undergrad. And by the time I left, he was saying to me, well, you know what? maybe you'd be interested in short selling, just because I was very skeptical of a lot of the things that he was looking at, as I should have been, because he covered microcaps. And I asked him, well, how do I do that? And he's like, oh, one of the guys I know or I talk to regularly does it. I really don't know. But anyway, I filed that away, went to law school, moved out to China. I was a lawyer there, and then started the first self-storage business in mainland China. And then I came across this fraud that was listed in the U.S. called Orient Paper. And I came across that because my father thought it could be a long, and he wanted me to do diligence on it. So when I looked at it, very quickly realized it was a near total fraud. So I published the report in June of 2010 on Orient Paper, and the report went viral, and immediately outreach from lots of investors all over. And it very quickly became clear to me that there was a business to be built here, exposing initially fraudulent Chinese companies. But this was, going back to the original question, I can't overemphasize how I suddenly felt like I had found myself. Because I thought, wow, I've been saying things out loud my whole life that get me in trouble, that are unpopular, make enemies. But this is actually something, because it's the markets, because people will effectively pay for this information. They want this information. I can actually, for the first time in my life, come out ahead, rather than just getting beat up, for saying the wrong thing. So,
his report was like a cathartic experience, I assume.
Especially in the beginning doing this, and particularly because I lived in China for a total of 6 years and then done business there. And initially we were exposing these guys who they beat me in China, basically. Like no matter how hard I tried as an entrepreneur in China, it just kept running into the guy who basically thinks the rules don't apply to him. And I'm operating within rules because, look, I'm governed by the U.S. Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. I was a U.S. qualified attorney. I couldn't play on their level. And so when it became clear to me that pretty much all these microcaps from China that were listed in the U.S. were frauds, I thought, oh, man, you guys have screwed up. You've come to you're in my territory now.
Yeah.
And now I can turn the tables. So yes, it was so cathartic those first few years. Eventually the excitement kind of dies down because, in the early days, oh my God, he really owns this company that's supposed to be the biggest supplier. Wow. And then, after a few years, it's, oh yeah, he owns the biggest company or the biggest supplier. Yeah, of course. Yeah, big deal. So, that's the one thing. It was like anything else. When you get used to it, it's never as good as the first time.
So now with this, not all the gory details about this, but with Orient Paper, there's different ways to understand, to I think figure out, or at least know if something's a fraud, or think that something's a fraud. Let's say, was it? I went to the Orient Paper facility and it literally wasn't there, or was it more of sleuthing of balance sheets and documents?
Well, Orient Paper was an accidental short, right? Because that was not my intention initially. So I went in, really, that's the only time I've done this on the short side. I went in through the front door. So my father had a good rapport with their air quotes CFO. And the reason I put it in air quotes is the template for these companies was that they would have a US-based, again, quote, air quotes CFO. And, that person really had no idea what was going on in China, but effectively their role was to market the stock to US investors. Mm-hmm. But my father didn't understand that. And so before I'd gone to take a look at Orient Paper or even cracked open a filing, my father and I had lunch with their CFO in Los Angeles around Thanksgiving of 2009, because I was back for the holiday. And I was just asking him basic questions because the company was, Orient Paper was raising money. They were going to add production capacity. And so I was asking, okay, well, what's for the new building? What's the construction cost per square meter? I don't know. Okay, what do you expect to spend on the actual equipment? Good question. I mean, just couldn't answer the most basic questions. But then there was this part that really was screaming red flag, where one of the things that they were talking about doing is they wanted to acquire this photo paper manufacturing line. Okay, so this is, again, late 2009. Mm-hmm. Even then, it's pretty clear that, you know, like printed photographs or you know, from Photomat are on their way out as a business. Right. And I asked who the seller is, and he said, oh, well, actually, the chairman of the company, the controlling shareholders, this guy, Chairman Leo, he said, oh, well, actually, Chairman Leo bought it some while ago and is holding it in trust until we raise the money and can buy it from him. I almost fell out of my chair. Like, whoa, wait a second. Buying this from Chairman Leo? Like, what did he pay? I don't know, but we're paying a fair price. How do you know? We had an independent valuation done. Okay, was that done by American Appraisal or one of the big four? No, it was done, I think, by a local Chinese firm in Baoding, China. And then now it's like, you know, screaming alarms. Like, okay, there's something really off here. Huh. But the question that I had when I then went back to China and looked at the filings and went up to visit the factory, the question that I had was, and this is, you know, like if we're being real here, if you're making investments in China, is the guy stealing too much money, right? So you expect that the controlling shareholders, you know, going to be doing some things to skim money. Is it an acceptable amount such that there's a good business here and you as an outside shareholder can still benefit, or is it an unacceptably large amount? I didn't understand until we got to the factory that this thing was a fake company. I mean, there was a kernel of truth to it. Like it for 2009, it would report having done, I think, $103 million in revenue. The real revenue was probably about $2.5 to $3 million. That's what it's
so it was actually running, but it was said. Yeah, it was running. It wasn't a shell, but it was far from truth.
Yeah, I mean it was more or less a Potemkin factory. I mean they had one truck like parked outside when we showed up with a bunch of bunch of paper rolls in the back, and that thing didn't move the entire time, and there was water everywhere in the workshop, which. You know, I'm not a manufacturing genius, but I know that if you're making paper, that's probably a bad idea. And the machines looked like they were, you know, probably 1980s, possibly early 90s, state-owned enterprise, basically throwaway machinery by that point in time. So, I guess the funniest part was, you know, their inventory, they claimed to have $5 million of raw materials, in inventory. And what they produced is they produced the corrugating medium. So if you look at a cross section of a cardboard box, the wavy stuff that goes in between the two sheets of what they call craft paper, they make that wavy stuff. And so the inputs for it are what's called OCC, old corrugated cardboard. So just old cardboard, you throw it into basically a blender with chemicals and spit out a slurry and, you know, make that into paper. So they had these piles of trash basically at the factory, and that's on the balance sheet for $5 million. And I brought a friend of mine with me who's a manufacturer. He came along as a consultant, and so he walked up one of those trash piles, looked around at the expanse of trash, came back down and goes, if this is worth $5 million, the world is a much richer place than I ever knew.
Gosh, that's crazy. Now, I'm going to fast forward a little bit. Actually, just a quick question. one of the ones you also came across was Sinophorus. Now, was that related because of the pulp and paper with trees, or is it, was that totally different?
No, that was totally different. Although there had been maybe about a year before that, 1 to 2 years prior to Sinophorus, was something called China Forestry, which was a reasonably large fraud blow up that was listed in Hong Kong. But that's not how or why we came to look at Sinophorus. I didn't even know about Sinophorus until somebody called me up and told me about it because it was listed in Canada. So I pretty much knew the name of every U.S. listed China-based business. But I, by early 2011, but I still hadn't heard of Sinophorus until somebody pointed it out to me specifically.
Now, when you went from research only to activist investor firm, is that a correct statement?
Well, not really. So I didn't know what to call, like, I had the muddy waters part, right? Which is a Chinese proverb, but should it be muddy waters research, analytics, analysis, capital? Like, so I called it Muddy Waters Research, but the idea was, I mean, look, when I wrote the first report on Orient Paper, I had no money. Like, I'd exhausted my savings trying to get the first self-storage business in mainland China off the ground. So I'd incinerated, about $700,000, which to me at the time was—
Yeah, huge, right?
Well, yeah, sure. That was actually, somewhat more than I had.
Plus you're trying to do it in China, which is obviously was a cheaper process.
Well,
cheaper process of Chinese money versus American money is what I'm saying.
Oh, right. So anyway, I'm at that point, like, I didn't have any money, and once I realized Orient Paper was a fraud, and I said, okay, we can write a report and send this out there and probably make some money. I tried to find a financial backer. I mean, my father was not interested. He said, I've never shorted a stock in my life. I'm not going to start now. He didn't have a moral objection to it. It just wasn't his thing. So he was out. I made some calls to people I knew in the investment industry. I mean, one of my friends worked at a by then reasonably large hedge fund, and he told me, when we caught up later, he's like, look, I'm not even supposed to be talking to you because compliance, when I went to them and said, hey, could we somehow pay this guy a portion of profit on this short report? So compliance said, you don't never talk to him again. So I couldn't find any money. So when I wrote the first report, I basically hit my credit card up for $2,000 to buy a bunch of puts. I never ended up making money on Orient Paper, when all was said and done. But after Orient Paper, it became clear, okay, I need to raise some money somehow and trade alongside these reports. So basically what we ultimately went to was I found what we now call a balance sheet provider. So this was somebody who had, was a hedge fund principal. So he had hedge fund pipes, which when you're short selling is very important because you often need to go to a number of different places to source borrow. We worked with a balance sheet provider for a few years, then had enough capital of our own, whereby we generally just traded in our own account. But not having the institutional pipes was a real limitation. So I was using Interactive Brokers, which for a retail product is great. But
they're the sponsor of the show, by the way.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, for retail product is great, but the problem was, it's like if they don't have borrow, they don't have borrow. And there's also, you don't have that. I mean, so I ended up raising, money for, it turned Muddy Waters into a fund management company. And so we manage various funds now. And, now we have that high touch institutional type service where we can contact various counterparties. Do you have this? No, I don't. Do you have it? Yeah, I do. Okay, how stable is it? Well, this part's stable, that part, I don't know. And so that helps us understand whether we should actually research something on the front end, like can we get borrow, and just how we should manage the risk of the short position. So it's just something that we honestly were not able to do, I think, well until we became institutional and started managing outside capital and had those institutional pipes.
Right. I want to throw something at you. We're going to cover, actually, even though Carson knows a lot about short selling, we're going to talk about some of his long ideas too, and some of the things that he's talking about is research in some areas. But we're going to take a quick break in a second. But before we do so, I want to throw out some names to you, and then I want to ask what happened. The 8 most famous short sellers, according to Google. I just threw it in there. I said, who are the most famous historical figures in short selling? This is what it came up with: Jesse Livermore, Jim Chanos, Andrew Left, David Einhorn, John Paulson, Bill Ackman, Carson Block, George Soros. Those are the names. The 8 most famous short sellers, which you're on. You're on. There was no particular order, although maybe it was 8. I mean, look, Jim Chanos, he lost 90% of his assets over the years. He had like $3.5 billion, is like nothing left. Who else?
Yeah, actually had over $7 billion in 2013, yeah. I believe.
By the way, that's healthy. Right?
It's a sign. I'd say it's a sign of the lack of health of the markets. I mean, he lost those AUM not through losses on positions, but through redemptions. And he got all these redemptions because, you know, year after year, clients were saying, well, look, we pay you for alpha. And, you know, and I think he was generating alpha most of those years. But, this, you know, the market's just not, I mean, the problem is his allocators or his clients had a hard time justifying why they were in a short strategy that was not when the S&P is going up blah percent, you know, pretty much every year. And you've got this other strategy that's designed to lose money when the market rips, you know, eventually it, you know, the issue was they were having a hard time justifying to their stakeholders why they were in a strategy that was losing money or not making that much money when they could just been in SPY and done really well.
But look at Andrew Left. He's pretty much out of the business. I mean, in terms of the short selling side, he made it clear. You look at Bill Ackman, maybe he's just keeping quiet about his short sales, but he made some big mistakes making a big huff about the whole Herbalife thing, right? Even made websites and Herbalife is bad for you, stuff like that. John Paulson, where is he, right? I mean, Hindenburg, which has come out with some great calls, great name, by the way. And, you know, their last call was Carvana. They said something about in a recent release that something about they had one more fraud, I think they said. No, one more, what did they say? Oh, one more Ponzi scheme that they reported the SEC. I don't know if that was Carvana or whatever, but they said Carvana was the greatest father and son grift of all time.
That's an interesting award category.
Yeah, right. Sure. I don't know how many are in that. But and you look at Carvana, you look at it like, what? In fact, by the way, anecdotally, I know somebody just last week that sold a car to Carvana, sight unseen, probably about $3,000 or $4,000, which was a $20,000 car, so it's a big piece, above anybody else in the neighborhood that would have offered anything, any of the big players. Picked it up, didn't even start it. So something to be said there. So is it the markets that just wore this all out, or is it maybe even the structure of how things are, like all this sovereign money that just keeps on flowing into things? Or is it that markets have corrected themselves? The inefficiencies have corrected themselves, which I can't believe.
Well, right. I mean, look, the way that Jim Chanos, you know, used to put it was when he first started on the short side in the early 80s, you could get, you know, in his view, you could get about 30 percentage points of alpha on the short side. And, you know, that later, you know, when I heard him discussing this, making this particular point, I think this was about 2013 or 14, and he was saying now it's down to about 15%. So markets have become more efficient, but certainly there are always inefficiencies. But I think that there are a few things that have gone on, right? So the biggest single issue on the short side is the response to the GFC which is also the same playbook that we ran in response to COVID, which is just massive amounts of monetary stimulus. And what this has done is this has anesthetized investors to risk. And so it used to be that on the long side, you were remunerated for caring about risk. But I feel that's not the case anymore. And like the, you know, if you're thinking about risk and you're thinking about, you know, the quality of the management and, you know, what's really underneath the numbers, then I think you're derided as a value investor and you're considered to be an anachronism.
Right, right.
Whereas
right,
what's really right. made the money on the long side is buying narratives. And that's automatically a difficult environment in which to be short, you know, where when risk doesn't really matter that much to investors, especially if you're in the activist short space where you're trying to communicate, hey, there are all these risks and problems to the company that you probably don't perceive. Activist short selling, it's different from traditional short selling in that activist short selling is always intended to make money. It's an absolute return type of strategy. Whereas traditionally, you know, short selling was, you know, the way that Jim always put it is he's selling insurance for when the market goes down. Mm-hmm. It becomes harder when people care less and less about these issues. And just Carvana's a great example because Carvana has been so controversial for so long. I feel like the issues with how the father and son transact with the company are so well known.
And no one cares.
That nobody cared. Nobody cared. It's like Tesla. Like, you know, whenever people talk to me, oh, why don't you talk about Tesla? Because everybody knows, right? And they don't care. So it's until there are real losses experienced and people remember why stewardship of companies is important and why the accuracy of information they're provided is important. Until that happens, it's a harder business than it really should be.
I love your analogy or the way you put it about growth investing the investing in narratives, because that is the thing that these great newsletters do. Have you ever seen these where they give you, I'm not talking about a story about the facts, but I'm talking about these stories and this pie in the sky of a small, I don't know, pick your poison, you know, gold mining operation in the outskirts of Canada that has a relationship with somewhere in Eastern Europe that's getting this stuff and they're doing, and they give this whole thing about each of the people and the stuff, but build it all up into this. It's like a conductor with a big orchestra, and you get this crescendo in the end of why it's worth, you know, 600 times more than it's worth now. You know,
right.
These $3 stock is really $120 stock that no one else knows about because of this incredible story about gold since the Middle Ages and the opportunities, and you know what I'm saying, right?
Right. Well, it's funny you bring, and I don't think this is why, but it's funny you bring up junior mining because we have actually recently launched a mining, you know, metals mining, not crypto. These days I have to distinguish fund, long oriented. And we've worked, there's somebody who's outside our firm who was running a mining book for reasonably decent sized fund in Toronto for some years. And we'd collaborated over the years with him, some long side activism, some Canadian listed miners. Anyway, so he's come effectively in-house to work with us. And, you know, it's funny when you talk about junior miners, and the way that we look at it is you can make venture type returns in junior mining, but you have a lot more information upon which to base your decisions than you do with venture. But there's so many dishonest people there where, you know, they take a lot of liberties with the assumptions used in their block models. So, you know, we're able, we believe, to generally see through that and understand who's gaming their models and who isn't. But yeah, I mean, one of the things that, you know, I think is really akin to what you're saying, one of the reasons that investors in this space have gotten smoked so many times is that they're investing in exquisite rock, right? But you'd rather buy, like I would rather be long good rock in a jurisdiction or in an area in which the project can actually happen than like the best rock that's ever been discovered in, you know, what in somewhere in Africa or, you know, somewhere that's really environmentally sensitive and you're just never going to get the approvals to actually develop the mine. So that's where, yeah, I mean, you can get these promoters will get people really excited about, you know, about the metallurgy, but they're ignoring the practical elements of what it takes to develop that.
But what they're also doing is really my point about those are because, as you know it, being involved in this, they're lower volume, relatively sometimes mm-hmm. can be obscure. And you can create all sorts of movement. And a newsletter, people sure. don't really understand this, but a newsletter oftentimes is doing this because they already have a long position and they put this deal out. Now, they may say they don't have much, whatever, but they put this out and then it just by the nature yep. of a good selling newsletter, it lifts the stock, right?
Yep. That's the old pump and dump, right? It's probably the oldest scam in stock markets.
Yeah. So let's just get back to one thing about why short selling is actually good for the market. The way I see it, you can totally tell me I'm full of crap. One of the things that I believe about short selling is it helps with price discovery, which has pretty much been obliterated because of, I think you would agree, passive investing and also of the general central bank puts, et cetera. Right? That whole thing mm-hmm. has been to a degree. Now, there's just pockets that are different. But generally speaking, when we look at Tesla and they say just this week, Tesla came out with their earnings and it was like, oh, no, it's not so good. But we're going to have some great things coming as they do. And everybody buys into the idea, right? But you look at these short sellers that are trying to find areas just like long people, you know, opportunities. But the difference is that when no one is left to buy anymore, when the markets mm-hmm. are hitting the skids, yep. when things are really bad, when everybody's panicked, when you and I on the long side are under our covers, cuddled up with a teddy bear, freaking out under the desk, okay? Because the markets have been going down for, God forbid, 3 days in a row these days, but you know, yeah. for months and months and months and months, and it's getting worse and worse, and everything's down 60, 70%. Who is left to buy? It's the short sellers, right? Take that.
Yeah.
Take that.
Yeah. No, that's 100% correct. And, you know, what I was talking about before, I said there are two macro issues that have really made short selling difficult. And I got into the monetary stimulus, the Fed put, but the other one, and you touched on it, is passive investing. And that's passive investing is really a big conversation in and of itself as to how it warps markets. But the thing is, with passive investing becoming such a really so dominant in especially the largest names in the indices, that creates this tremendous fragility. And here's the thing, you know, the passive buyers, you know, when a passive fund buys a share of stock, they effectively remove it from the float because no matter what price that stock gets to, passive will not sell unless and until it has outflows. So no matter how stupid that stock price is. So that's why you get this parabolic uplift in share prices when you have passive buying, because they're removing those shares from the float. But here's the thing. There will come a day, I mean, maybe not in our lifetimes, but there will come a day when there are net outflows from passive and passive turns into sellers. And passive, the allocation of active to passive has really taken all this dry powder out of the markets. So when those passive funds go in and start hitting the bids because they have to meet redemptions, who is going to be there to catch the falling knives? The only bids in the marketplace, you know, if they're still around, are going to be short sellers who are covering at some level. Otherwise, what's the floor? That's a very, you know, so this is really, it's, there are two issues here and there, and this is where they are interrelated, but it's passive investing and it's in the risk, the fragility that it's putting into the markets, but also, yeah, that's the day you're going to want short sellers to be there covering.
Yeah. So talk to me about you like and you're getting more involved in the area of long bias mining. So just to put a final point on that, what I mean, I know you have people and you have a great person doing this. Is that been something that's interested you for a while? Because that's kind of a very specific area.
Yeah, well, we got involved in that in 2017 when when this guy was, his name is Darren McLean. So Darren came to us and he said, "Look, I'm short this this company called Asanko Gold. It's got gold mines in West Africa. You know, I think it's misrepresenting. You know, a lot of the information presents to investors. I've written on it publicly, but you know, that didn't move the needle that much. And maybe you guys would find this interesting." So, you know, we hired some geologists or engaged some geologists, validated his work, and then we published on it. And part of the problem that he had was he just communicated in an extremely technical way. So it was difficult to understand what he was saying. And that was a great short for us. Darren then came back maybe a year and a half later and said, I've got this long. It's a really fat pitch. It's called GT Gold. And so we ended up setting up a special purpose vehicle to invest in GT Gold. We put it in our funds. And we ultimately had to go alongside activists on it to try to force a sale, because we really didn't, you know, we thought that the board was not comporting itself in a manner that was in the best interest of outside investors such as ourselves. And so GT Gold got sold to Newmont, and it was a five bagger. Wow. And that was, and you know, that when that happens, I said, you know, I used to talk about how I find it so much less satisfying to be on the long side. And, you know, and I really like this idea of being on the short side, and, you know, outsmarting everybody. But God damn, if it doesn't feel good to make 5x on my money and not like really.
And nobody took you out back and beat you up.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. It's just so much less drama. And so we've collaborated with Darren going long in our funds and a few other names. And ultimately, or, you know, most recently, we became disclosed public shareholders of another Canadian listed company. Also, mine is also located in Canada, called Mayfair Gold. And that was not intended to be a longside activist position for us. But we then, early last year, you know, we started having some serious conversations with the board of Mayfair, and we really didn't like the answers they were giving us. So we ran a proxy contest this past June, and we got all five directorships with over 91% of the vote.
Wow.
So that's impressive. So I'm now, I mean, it really, really calls into question why these guys fought us. Like, if we made it clear early on, we had a majority of shares, you know, backing us here. So just for them to have spent all this time and money, you know, just like, it's just inexplicable. But that also illustrates how you do get in mining. You do have so many really poor quality boards and management. You know, like one of the things with mining is that, I mean, how many really smart people do you know who've graduated from, you know, school, you know, from 2000 onward, have said, "Oh, I know, I want to go into mining." I mean, they go into
something
finance, they go into and so there's such a dearth of talent, both on the operating side in mining, but also on the capital allocation side. And like, we think it's a really exciting space. And if you believe that we're going to be decarbonizing our economy, like, that's, you know, that's just a great macro tailwind for mining, because a lot of stuff has to be pulled out of the ground. Now, we're not doing this because of that macro theme, but, you know, we just see so many inefficiencies in the space. Yeah, look, really excited about that.
Cool.
One.
And now, one of my favorite countries in the world is something that you are going along. This is a place in Asia, which, if you haven't visited out there, gang, get on a plane, get on a boat, do something, because small country, but yet vibrant, one of cost-effective, good people, hardworking, and the output's pretty amazing. And I think a beneficiary, unfortunately, of the losses from China's COVID, which is Vietnam.
Yeah, yeah. So that's actually in April of 2020, after, thinking about the world, I said, when we come out of COVID, we're going to see the largest geopolitical realignment we've seen since World War II. And it's all about how the world relates to China. So these, the pieces on the board are going to move significantly. What's the trade? And it became clear pretty quickly that, at least relative to the size of its economy and its markets, that Vietnam would be the single largest beneficiary of the redirection of FDI flows away from China. And so the question was, well, is there a good way to play this? And look, it's, it's currently classified as frontier market, but there are public companies that, we think are, are good companies over the long term. The way we look at what we're doing in Vietnam is we're trying to back the best entrepreneurs. And so we think we've identified, good portfolio of these entrepreneurs, and they're not people who are going to abuse outside shareholders. But we've had an office on the ground there for over 3 years, and they're, when we started it, there are names that foreigners routinely traffic in, and as we kind of peeled back the layers and really started to understand things, we came to believe that most of those are not where we'd want to be. And so our book is largely off the beaten track kind of names, but, we do think that these will compound well, over a multi-year period.
I guess probably if I was in the room there with you, I'm just thinking, again, I could be totally wrong about these things, but, and you may be like, what are you saying? But if we were in the room thinking about who was going to be that beneficiary of the shift from China, which, by the way, they became even more of a beneficiary the longer China stayed closed, right? That was the issue, because everybody was freaking out. I would think the list was like a short list, right? You got Indonesia, maybe Thailand, Cambodia, Singapore, Laos, but you got to scratch most of those, right? You got to scratch Cambodia because after, unfortunately, what happened during the Khmer Rouge and all that, this never came back, right? Thailand, probably close second, I would think, possibly to Vietnam.
Well, I mean, yeah, but Thailand, Thailand's more developed than Vietnam is, and it's growing, but Thailand has a lot of structural issues, and they've got from a governance perspective, they're somewhat of a basket case. The red shirts and yellow shirts constantly vie with each other, and you have these coups every few years. That I think does put somewhat of a speed brake on how well Thailand will do. Indo, yeah, resource rich, just a really, really difficult place to do business. I mean, corruption
it's also religiously, there, religiously hardcore.
Yeah, and look, Vietnam obviously has corruption issues. It's not it's not a strong rule of law, but Indonesia, I think, is just next level. They say it's gotten better, but I don't know. But a country you have to put on that list also is India. And when I think about from a purely geopolitical perspective, the countries that are going to do the best in this world are in terms of being able to reap the benefits of both sides when we're in this now bipolar world again, are the ones that are non-aligned, like Vietnam, like India. And Vietnam is—it's interesting how they see the world. When I was in Vietnam a couple of years ago, shortly after the Ukraine war had started, I was speaking with a reasonably senior U.S. government official based there, and she said, when I was talking with the Vietnamese official shortly after the Ukraine war broke out, and just getting their thoughts, I was expecting them to, blame it on Russia or whatever. They blamed it on Ukraine. And I said, well, how's that? And he said, well, come on. They're next door. Okay, Ukraine is next door to this giant Russia. Okay. And Russia attacked because Ukraine did not do a good job of balancing them against the Europeans. They leaned too hard in the European direction, and of course that would be the result. And the lesson gets applied to Vietnam in the same way, because I mean, Vietnam borders China. Now, Vietnam, I mean, the people of Vietnam have a real deep-rooted antipathy towards mainland China. I mean, I think especially the Chinese government. But Vietnam knows that it can never run all the way into the embrace of the U.S. because that will trigger China to act aggressively toward Vietnam. So effectively, in this world where China and U.S. or China and U.S. are such, are engaged in this, this struggle, this competition, the countries that play us off against China effectively are going to benefit quite a bit from it. So this is Carson Block, the pragmatist speaking, versus Carson Block, the patriot who wants to see us, decouple from China, and send those bastards packing. Right. But that's the reality of the geopolitical situation we're in.
So hopefully I'll be able to visit your office. Maybe we can meet over for a little. One of the greatest things in the world you could ever have is Vietnamese coffee, by the way.
Very sugary, but it is good.
I'm still, it was 8 years ago that I was there. I'm still working off some of that caffeine and that sugar from that trip. But I'll be going to India actually in about 3 weeks. So that's going to
be. Kidding. I'm going to be in India, in second half of February also for a few days.
Really?
Yeah. Singapore, Vietnam, and India.
Yeah. I'll be doing the whole half tourist, half business about 12 days.
Okay.
There. Yeah. So my first time. Nice. I've never been there before.
Same here. Yeah, this will be my first time.
So hopefully both of us won't get sick, because that's the everybody every time he talks, the deli belly, man, don't eat stuff. Don't eat.
I think I'm just going to be eating hotel meals. Right. That's lame to say, but I do not want to have horrible digestive issues on that flight back to the U.S.
How bad is
no
that?
No way.
Well, because other people do, and you don't want to have to deal with that.
That too, yeah.
but it's funny because I eat, just as a point of reference, my audience knows, I'll eat anything anywhere, right? I mean, I've been to places all over the world, every country I've mentioned to you I've been to, and I'll eat anything anywhere, right? I'll eat in the streets, I'll do whatever. I go to cooking class, I go to the markets, I do things. India, I'm not doing it. I mean, really not doing it. Not maybe I'll do it. No, I am not.
Yeah.
Eating anything.
Yeah.
So
it's next world.
Good stuff. Carson Block, we're going to have all the information on how to get in touch with you on the show notes for episode number 906. On thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Anywhere else you want to tell people they can get stuff from you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you go to muddywatersresearch.com, you can email us at info@muddywatersresearch.com. And it's also our Vietnam website, which is muddywatersasia.com. And we also have muddywatersresources.com. So
now, don't you think you should have crystal clear waters? .com for your long exposure, or are you going to keep up with the muddy waters?
I know, right? yeah, that's a thought. I'd say if we were going opposite, it'd be clear skies.
Ah, yes. Yes, clear blue skies. Good stuff. Carson, Carson Block, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks, Andrew. Good talking to you.
And that's going to wrap up another episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Very excited about all the guests and all the things we're talking about over the next several months. Next week, Danielle DiMartino Booth is going to be our guest. You know, she's a Fed insider. Make sure to subscribe. Go to Apple. Go to Spotify. Go to YouTube. Go to Amazon. I mean, Apple's the main place that people listen these days. But anywhere you get your podcast, you can find The Disciplined Investor. And also make sure to tell your friends, your family, listen, shout it out the window. Give people a heads up. You want to make some money? You want to get disciplined? You want to have financial security? Listen to The Disciplined Investor. Other names we have coming up, we have Daniel Crosby, Behavioral Finance, Carly Garner, Med Faber. The list goes on and on. We're literally booked through June with A guests, A rated, A level, the top, the best in the business. Thanks for joining me this week and every week. I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions.
nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.